Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode number 271, recorded for the week of August 6th, 2024. AWS deprioritizes 7 services. Cloud Pod hosts prioritize therapy. Good evening, Jonathan and Matt. How are you doing?
Great. How about you?
Therapy's been helping, so going well.
Looking forward to time off?
Yes, I am. One more week, and then I'm gone, and then you guys are on your own again for another week.
All right, we'll manage.
Yep. Hopefully AI will help you out once again. All right. Well, Amazon did officially deprioritize 7 cloud services, as long as your official notification comes from Twitter and Jeff Barr directly. He tweeted right after the show recorded last week, about an hour and a half, actually, after we finished, that they had made the tough decision to deprioritize 7 cloud services. Amazon is continuing new access to a small number of services in the tweet, but will continue to run them in a secure environment for the foreseeable future. He confirmed the list of services to be S3 Select, Cloud Search, Cloud9, SimpleDB, Forecast, Data Pipeline, and Code Commit. And an AWS spokesperson claimed to Business Insider that the changes were communicated through multiple channels within and outside the company. And I say shenanigans. They were not communicated outside the company in any way that I was aware of. And, you know, we're a Cloud Pod podcast that checks the news of cloud providers. So something I'd be aware of normally.
Yeah, they kind of took a leaf out of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book and put the plan commission in the filing cabinet downstairs with the broken light.
All I just heard there was Dr. Mustard in the library with the with the knife, or I don't know what you said, but that was where my mind went to clue.
Yeah,
I mean, some of these services haven't really been updated in years. Like Cloud Search, I mean, I looked it up right after that, the announcement. The last real update, even on their blog, was 2015. So clearly, that's been deprioritized for a while.
Well, and SimpleDB, I think, unless you were an existing client for a long time, you couldn't get access to that either. Just you couldn't get access to EC2 Classic unless you had an account created in the era that it existed. The only one of these that surprises me in any real shape and form is probably Forecast. Data Pipeline makes sense to me that they're killing that, because I think EventBridge is superior to it anyways. But Forecast, I guess they're thinking of that one is that AI is probably a better use for trying to do that type of forecasting they were trying to do. But they were taking basically a set of numbers and it would basically provide you forecasting data to forecast future needs. And it was an Amazon service. I assumed Amazon was using it for some of their stuff internally, but maybe it didn't work as well as they thought. And they stopped using it. And then customers also realized the same thing and stopped using it too.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised by Cloud9. I feel like definitely have seen people use it like very niche cases, like small companies. And it works nicely in that little ecosystem where if you're just want to play with something, inside of Amazon and do a quick proof of concept and it can connect to everything. It's a nice secure location of it as their cloud IDE. I thought it was kind of nice.
I mean, I think once they built the shell into the console, I think the need for it started to diminish pretty quickly. And then the VS Code plugins for Amazon are so good that I don't know that you needed Cloud9 at that point. And because you had to pay for servers to make Cloud9 actually work, people weren't always a big fan of it because it wasn't serverless. And so I just think between VS Code and getting Amazon Shell into the console, I think they just lost both of the needs that they had.
Yeah, I only ever looked at Cloud9 once after the acquisition, and I thought, well, this looks, this is okay. Never used it though. already have our existing ecosystem of PyCharm and things like that, which can do remote shells and remote Docker and all those other things. So it really didn't add any new value. I mean, I guess it was an easy button to get people into the ecosystem, but
that's the way I viewed it, as the quick, easy button, go run this quick POC, follow these instructions, but I think Justin's right also with the Cloud Shell integration. I think that also took over half of its real purpose.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, rest in peace, S3 Select and Cloud Search and all the rest of you. We won't miss you that much, apparently, because we really didn't use you, which is also why Amazon killed them. But we'll see kind of what happens with other future services. But hopefully they do a better job in deprecation going forward and come out with better notification periods, because This just seemed a little sneaky. And you know, again, it deteriorates trust with customers who potentially were building things on these products. So
yeah, it's very unusual. I don't think I've ever been quite so amateurish around product announcements like this. It's kind of strange.
Yeah.
I mean, what other products do you really know that they've completely deprecated out though, or services?
EC2 Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's the only real one I can think of. So like this is them trying to figure out how to actually do this without backlash.
I mean, they basically have announced the deprecation of the metadata service V1, haven't they? Like, I mean, it's still a long ways out. It's like another year, I think, to go. But they did announce when they came up with the metadata service too that, you know, you had the 3-year window before they were going to retire it.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it is a breaking change in that case. It's not like Aurora, where the new one works just like the old one, but better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
It sounds like, you know, but even internal to Amazon, you know, there were some people who posted some Slack messages from internal Amazon Slack that, you know, they had been pitching to their customer just the week before using something like Data Pipeline or using S3 Select or one of these other tools, or Code Commit, maybe. I don't know which one it was exactly, but, you know, they were just pitching that a week ago to a prospect. And, you know, so even internally, they were caught by surprise.
A lot of training material is going to refer to all these things. Yep. So it's a lot of work to go back and fix it. Yes. Yeah. Especially yeah. Certifications. I'm most disappointed out of all of them. I'm kind of disappointed about Code Commit. I don't really care for the others. Mm-hmm. SimpleDB has got, you know, a dozen replacements that you could plug in anymore. DocumentDB or DynamoDB. Cloud9 probably wasn't going anywhere anyway. Cloud Search has been replaced by new technology. S3 Select was good for what it did, but I don't know if there's
kind of Athena
was better.
Yeah,
more expensive but better.
Having a code repository in AWS was kind of nice, especially with IAM protected branches and things like that.
Well, there's still other places where you sort of still have a code repository. Like Amplify kind of has a lightweight code repository capability, and there's a couple other places that I thought were always built on top of Code Commit, to be honest, but apparently we're not. So,
yeah.
Or they are in the next wave of services.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, well, moving on to general news and earnings season once again. Earnings were a bit of a bloodbath. I'm going to break it out for you right now. Alphabet revenue was up 14% year over year, driven by search and cloud, with GCP surpassing $10 billion in quarterly revenue and $1 billion in operating profit for the first time ever. GCP cloud revenue was $10.35 billion versus expected $10.2 billion. However, shares were down because YouTube advertising screwed them again, missing by $300 million. So there you go. Cloud revenue overall was up 29%. Which has been about on par with where Google has been on cloud revenue growth the last few quarters.
Amazing how much YouTube was down, you know, and how it negatively affected everything altogether. I'm also always fascinated by how much revenue they make from YouTube advertising.
Oh, it's so much money. So much money. I mean, it's basically eyeballs for children at this point. But, you know, the problem is they're competing against TikTok and Instagram Reels and Facebook Shorts and all those things, and they're taking a lot of eyeballs away. And so advertisers are spreading out their dollars, especially with the, you know, macro climate that we're in. So yeah, it's sort of interesting. So yeah, Google taken down by TikTok. That's great. Microsoft shares dipped on Wednesday as investors looked past the better than expected earnings and revenue and focused instead on disappointing cloud results. But executives provided a dose of optimism when they predicted cloud growth speed up will occur in the first half of 2025. I don't know what crystal ball they have on that, but I'd love to know more. Revenue was $64.73 billion versus expected $64.39 billion. And Azure revenue only grew 29% for the quarter, but Wall Street had expected a 31% growth, which is why they were penalized after earnings on Tuesday.
That's interesting. 29% for Azure, but they expected 31%, but 29% for Google was just fine.
Well, when you're talking about, I mean, they've been 29% for a couple quarters. So
yeah,
this is just the issues of that. And then finally, Amazon also had a bad day, but they missed on revenue, which is never good. Don't miss on revenue. Revenue was $147.98 billion. AWS is up $26.3 billion versus a $26 billion expectation. But Amazon suffered an overall lower average selling price, or ASP, as they call it in the biz, due to pressure from Temu, which is the reason for the abysmal retail findings. So revenue miss and profitability was down due to lower ASP that hurt Amazon. But what we care about, AWS up $26.3 billion.
Nice. Have you ever bought anything from Temu?
I have not. My kids have.
Okay.
It's actually not bad. So there was another app before Temu, which I'm trying to remember the name of. And everything I bought from that was just absolutely terrible and horrific. But the Temu stuff has been relatively okay. It comes pretty quickly. And, you know, it's made in China, cheap stuff. But it was better than, you know, the previous app that I was using for that kind of stuff.
Everything's made in China.
Yeah. But there's different quality in China depending on where you're at.
I buy like cheap things I don't care about from it, like the pads you put underneath a chair. Yeah, that you probably end up should replace once a year because they fall off. And either way, you know, like things like that, that like, as long as you have patience to get them, it doesn't bother me that much.
Yeah. The app I was thinking of that was compared to Temu, Wish. So I Wish many times during the pandemic and was many, many times disappointed in what arrived. So I kind of stopped using those. But my kids have had much better luck with Temu. They bought, in fact, this week they just got some stuff like these rubber balls they're bouncing around the house, driving me crazy with, and a couple other things. One of the kids bought a full arm sleeve of temporary tattoos. and I'm like, how much did all this cost? He's like, $7. I was like, all right, it's fine.
You're not even mad about it. Like, I'm proud of you.
I mean, like, you know, they get allowance through Apple Pay, and you know, they take Apple Pay at Temu, so that's what happens.
All right.
It's better than them spending it on other junk that they're spending it on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with the economy the way it is globally, it makes sense if people get smart and realize that they don't need something next day or in 2 days. If they can plan ahead and take a couple of weeks to get something for a third of the price, why not?
Yeah. Well, and they are able to track the shipping and all that. I think he ordered it on a Sunday and it came like on Thursday. So it wasn't like that long of a wait for him to wait for it. And, you know, you can buy some of that same stuff on Amazon and get it in 2 days, but you're paying twice the price.
Yeah, I was actually talking to somebody yesterday about buying from kind of like the Chinese resellers, even on Amazon. And their customer service is actually very good because they value your reviews so much that if you've got the slightest problem and you email and say, I've got an issue with this thing. I bought it 3 months ago. It's not covered by Amazon's return anymore. It stopped working. They're like, here, have a new one. What's your address? We'll get it shipped out right away. No hassles whatsoever. So it's an interesting twist of outcomes, really.
Yep, indeed. Well, moving on to AI is how ML makes money. Snowflake is announcing Snowpark Container Service is now generally available in all AWS commercial regions and Azure public preview now. Customers can get fast access to GPU infrastructure without needing to self-procure instances or make reservations with their public cloud provider. So I can only imagine that if you're buying it from AWS and then reselling it to me through Snowflake, that's going to cost a lot more money than it would have been if I just got it from AWS. But maybe you appreciate the Snowflake UI and capabilities they have to the table. But it's interesting because at some point I could see how Snowflake would potentially take something like this and saying, well, you know, we're now going to arbitrage against the cloud providers to get better pricing. Because if you can, you know, if I'm now running the containers and I'm an abstraction layer, I now have pressure to push on the cloud providers, or do they build their own data centers at some point in the future and then start undercutting other vendors?
Yeah, the hardware first.
Well, the servers are fine. The GPUs are tough.
The GPUs is what I was referencing.
Yeah. Well, if Intel and everyone else could ever, you know, start getting competitive chips to NVIDIA, maybe that would be a thing.
I mean, they might have a true multi-cloud story of, we don't really care about the ingress and egress feeds because we're running it on spot and we've played the game enough with all the cloud providers that we're able to move the data, and even that extra cost isn't that big of a deal.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if they ended up spinning up their own data centers. I think having the data in the cloud close to other the customer's existing infrastructure is probably a lot more valuable than the extra money they'd make on not paying.
I don't know. If they were offering 10-20% less for certain services than what AWS is providing to their companies, and you're already a Snowflake customer and you already have your data lake there, like, I can see the play to save margin. So we'll see. It's an interesting one to keep an eye on, because I definitely think there's potential for some interesting things Snowflake or Databricks could do in the future if they wanted to strike the hand that feeds them in some ways. So we'll see. Moving to AWS, they have a great blog post this week introducing their recent adoption of the Open Container Initiative, or OCI, Image and Distribution Specification for Amazon Elastic Container Registry. This latest version includes support for image referrers, as well as significant enhancements for distribution of non-image artifacts. This now allows you as a customer to more easily manage your container images with the ability for customers to push image signatures, software bill of materials, attestations, and other content related to a specific image right alongside their images hosted in Amazon ECR. And so I appreciate that Amazon is adopting an open standard here. And this blog post goes into a lot of details how you actually implement these things. And just a good article that I got a lot out of, so I thought I'd share it.
I mean, being able to push these other artifacts next to it is really key, especially as, you know, everyone needs to build these SBOMs out for all their software as a service that they have. And, you know, the attestations are always all useful. So keeping everything kind of in sync with the artifact and being able to say in this version, we have this, and keeping everything in one place, I think will streamline a lot of pain that people have to deal with right now.
Yep, totally agree. It'd be nice not to have to store that stuff somewhere else in S3, for example. And kind of link them somewhere else, because now you need a database somewhere else to link the objects in the registry with the attestations someplace else. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. I wish it wasn't called OCI, though. It just makes me think of Oracle all the time.
Well, I mean, I think they existed before Oracle, so technically yeah. Oracle should change their name. That's what I say.
I first saw the article on our notes, and I was like, why are we talking about Oracle in the AWS section with ECR? What's going on? So...
Oh, that would be quite the get, wouldn't it?
I thought you were screwing me. So, yeah, I wouldn't blame you.
Yeah. Well, Amazon is announcing the general availability of Amazon Titan Image Generator V2 model with new capabilities in Bedrock. You can guide image creation using reference images, edit existing visuals, remove backgrounds, generate image variations, and securely customize the model to maintain brand style and subject consistency. There are several new features over V1, including image conditioning or using a reference image along with a text prompt, image guidance with a color palette, background removal capabilities, and subject consistency for fine tuning. I decided to go play with it. And I'm going to tell you, it didn't go well. a couple things about this model. So, you know, first of all, it's been a while since I went to Bedrock. So Bedrock's got a lot of new features that I hadn't checked out. But you basically get to choose if you want to use, if you're doing background removal or you're doing image creation from text. Like, it isn't just a multimodal model that can just do those things natively. You have to tell it, which is sort of... a bit of a challenge, but you know, I said, okay, fine. Well, let me just give you a prompt and have you draw something for me. And so I first attempted to take our profile photos from the website and put them in there. And then it said, well, I can't create create real people. And I'm like, darn you, AI safety features. So I had to go a little bit more generic. And so I wrote a prompt, which is not good, but we'll get to this in a second. So draw three podcast hosts sitting at a table. They are super annoyed talking about their thousands AI story and long for the days of talking about new instance types or network switches. The host should be male. One should be bald with a goatee, which would be me. One should be balding with a goatee, which is Matt. And one should have normal haircut and no facial hair. I didn't think it would understand what British was, so I didn't put that in for Jonathan. And it produced this first image, which you guys can now see. You know, we all have a very annoyed face. Matt is cross-eyed, and these will all be in the show notes. So don't worry. You can take a look at these if you're listening to our audio show. Jonathan definitely does not look anything like Jonathan because he has a slick-backed Elvis-style haircut. I have added mutton chops to my goatee, and I've definitely lost about 150 pounds. So that's great. I appreciate that part of the AI. So I said, okay, fine, I'll take my prompt and let's go move it over to Gemini. And then Gemini told me, yeah, we still can't generate images of people because it would have made one of us black, which would have been unfortunate. So that's still broken, by the way, since it's been months now since that was an issue. And then ChatGPT drew us as a cartoon, but gave all three of us goatees, which is sort of funny because I specifically said not to. And then again, I lost 150 pounds here. Matt and Jonathan both have hair. and one is gray and one is like a total, Moe and Curly cut going on for, I think, Matt in the middle there. I think that's Matt. I don't know which one is Matt in this particular thing. So then I said, okay, fine. You know, my prompts are probably bad. Maybe I can get this improved. So I asked Gemini to improve the prompt so it could be part of the show here. And it gave us a new prompt, which is then Titan and ChatGPT then tried to generate. So ChatGPT's second attempt was a little bit better. I mean, the background, the AI on the table, the computer stuff, I like a little better. Still, all three of us have a goatee. I've also still lost 200 pounds in this one. Jonathan is much bulkier. Like, you've been working out, which, yeah, good for you, man. And then Matt's just leaning on his chin, you know, sad about his Azure days, I think, is really what's happening there.
And knew of all the Azure outages that we've been going through over here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then the Titan image generator produced the last one, which for some reason I have, there's two of us bald in this one. All three of us have a goatee or beard. And I think I'm the one in the middle with my mouth wide open, like looking like a Corey Quinn photo. And then Matt is very concerned to the left, and Jonathan has his swooped back hair. Also not looking very British in that photo either. So, yeah, the, a couple things that were interesting. Number one is Titan is definitely creating images. You know, it's trying to recreate photos, which, you know, was sort of missed on me when I first read through the article. And I then realized as I was playing with it. And it's got a lot to be desired still in general, I think. But yeah, this is a little bit of fun for you guys to check out.
I think it's funny how you specifically said three podcast hosts, and then in the first picture, there's two mics. Yeah. Sorry, there's three mics all in front of one person.
Yeah, that is good too.
And then there's another one with two mics, and the person in the middle has none. The last one's pretty good. The last one is actually impressive, not because of the looks on our faces or anything, but it does look a lot more photographic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can choose which style you like. I still think Stable Diffusion is probably,
which is also available to you in Bedrock. I did not compete with Stable Diffusion because I didn't have that kind of time. But
yeah,
it's sort of interesting though. Everyone's so worried about AI taking over everything, and I just sort of look at this and I'm just like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a great prompt writer. The new prompt that it wrote, the improved prompt, by the way, was three podcast hosts at a table in a cozy recording studio surrounded by professional microphones and scattered notes. The expressions clearly convey frustration as they discuss their 1,000th AI story, longing for the days when they focus on new instance types and network routing. The first host is a bald male with a goatee. The second is a balding male with a goatee. And the third is a male with a normal haircut and no facial hair. The studio is filled with the various tech gadgets and equipment, creating an atmosphere that reflects their awareness with AI topics. So, yeah, just sort of funny. But, the facial hair thing is interesting because, like, I specifically told it no, without a goatee on the one person. And normally it's pretty good about negative prompts, but in this particular case, it was not.
I think instead of saying first, second, and third person, I think you'd get more success if you, like, the person on the left, person in the middle, person on the right, because it understands position in the frame, but not.
That's a good call.
But not the number.
Yeah. Well, you should definitely try to take my prompt, Jonathan, and see if you can make it better. I'll give you access to the CloudPod account and you can play with Bedrock. It didn't cost me more than a couple of dollars.
So, you should actually type in our last couple months of podcasts and see if then how it generates us based on what we talk about and how we talk about it.
What do you think this guy looks like based on what he sounds like or what he talks about?
Unfortunately, Anthropic, which I know is where you're feeding in most of our audio, doesn't do drawings yet. But I, you know, the strikingness of the fact that the Titan requires you to choose what you want to do, the multimodal models are so nice. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like to have to think that hard about which one I want is not something I want to do. But that's also why those things are cheaper too, because they're specialized in those ways. But when you're trying to do just general stuff with a model, ChatGPT, Anthropic, etc., they all have a big win there.
Yeah. It's still awesome though. I mean, I've seen some fantastic AI generated images. And I think the weird fingers show up in the images from is that the last one's Titan? Yeah.
Yeah.
Still got weird fingers, but I've seen some fantastic AI generated images which are virtually indistinguishable from real life anymore.
Yeah, and the one from ChatGPT, which is, you know, after the revised prompt, I'm pretty sure I have I have 11 fingers if I were to count them. But yeah, it's interesting. But yeah, it's sort of funny because I see a lot of AI generated stuff right now for the political campaign happening in the US right now.
Oh, yeah, surprise, surprise.
And there's a lot of weird idiosyncrasies. So there's like a whole subreddit now who just come out with like, hey, here's an AI generated image from this campaign and here's what they used it for and here's how you know it's AI. And they point out all the flaws, which is kind of fun. So it's sort of like the old days of like, is this Photoshop or not? But now with AI, and I'm kind of enjoying that.
Which is the subreddit? Because I definitely want to follow that.
I'll send it to you. I don't remember the top of my head, but yeah, it's basically, is it AI or not, or something like that. And it basically, they tell you how it's AI models. All right, moving to GCP. They're announced at Next, the Compute Engine X4 and C3 bare metal machine types. And now today, they're telling you they're generally available. The machine types address unique compute needs with general purpose and memory optimized families, with the new X4 instance series including three new instance types to address extra large in-memory database needs such as SAP S/4HANA. Three new C3 bare metal shapes cater to a variety of applications such as commercial and custom hypervisors that require direct access to CPU and memory resources. Underpinning both of these instances is Titanium, Google Cloud's system of purpose-built custom silicone and multiple tiers of scale-out offloads. By freeing up the CPU, Titanium provides performance, reliability, and security improvements for a variety of workloads.
Awesome. Generally available. That means you can now ask your account rep if you can have some of them and say no in any region you choose.
Yeah. Or they'll tell you that you can get them in one availability zone of a region.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get redundancy. That's my favorite answer.
I still always want a good reason to play with bare metal. I've never had a good, solid use case. Like, I know, like, if you're big into Windows, it helps with licensing and stuff like that, or like you want a straight SQL, but I never had a good reason to. I always find ways around having to deal with this.
Yeah, every time it comes up with someone saying it's an option, I come up with all the reasons why it's not a good idea and typically talk them out of it. I mean, you lose so many advantages of having, you know, the cloud and, you know, virtual, you know, even though you don't get direct access to the hypervisor to move things around, you know, in Amazon, you just turn the instance off, turn it back on, it gets moved to a different host. You know, and things like that that just don't happen with bare metal.
Do you still got a metadata service with bare metal? They still provide that through the...
Yes, they do.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's not true. I think the only time I've ever had to run, I don't know if it's bare metal or not, I ran Mac on Amazon at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Is that technically bare metal, or
yes,
all
that is bare metal? Yeah. That is bare metal too.
So I did have to. I did that at one point.
Yeah, the Nitro card provides a metadata service to even bare metal.
Okay.
Google Spanner is expanding the types of capabilities it can support with several new variants. First up is Spanner Graph, offering you an intuitive and concise way to match patterns, traverse relationships, and filter results in interconnected data to serve common graph use cases such as personalized recommendations, finding communities, or identifying fraud. The new Spanner Advanced Full Text Search builds on Google's decades of search expertise to bring powerful matching and relevance ranking over unstructured text, as well as now supporting vector searches, supporting semantic information retrieval, the bedrock of generative AI applications, building on 12 plus years of Google research and innovation in approximate nearest neighbor algorithms. In addition, to meet all those complex cost and compliance needs of enterprise customers, they're also giving you geo-partitioning, which allows you to deploy while storing parts of your data in specific regions to support fast local access and data sovereignty. Dual region configurations offering multi-region availability properties while respecting data sovereignty. And auto-scaling automatically adjusts the size of your Spanner deployment, allowing you to quickly react to changes in traffic patterns without the need to overvision. These new capabilities are available to you in either the Spanner Enterprise or the Spanner Enterprise Plus versions of Spanner.
Excellent. I finally have a reason to use Spanner now. I was going to use Neo4j, but that's a lot more complex.
Yeah, this is great.
Simply because, you know, marketplace agreement. I mean, the product Neo4j is great. Don't get me wrong, but as far as native cloud services go, Spanner is so much easier to use through Terraform. And they, instead of building their own standard for the graph query language, they used an open standard, which is nice, GQL, because Neo4j doesn't support GQL yet, and I think they're still working on it. But that's really nice, because now I can pivot to something else if it sucks.
you gotta get it to work in your GCP account first, though, so that's step one.
I just hate how they do enterprise, enterprise plus, enterprise premium. Like, I feel like we're getting to, like,
speaks of the enterprise, the Azure guy who's got ultra and ultra disk premium, and
he buys it. There's, you know, even for like Redis on Azure, it's like standard and premium and isolated. And I'm like, why?
Yeah.
Like, so it drives me crazy as they go down these routes of like, oh, we built something, but now we want to charge more for it. You know, we can't roll it in. So we're going to charge extra and extra and extra. So we have to have all these tiers and figuring out which tier works for you. You're starting to get back into like the Microsoft PhD of licensing with some of these things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I mean, the Amazon way is also sometimes problematic, though, because there's thousands of knobs you can turn, and some of those knobs cost a lot of money and some of them don't. And so if you don't want to have risk of someone turning on the expensive knobs, you with Enterprise or Enterprise Plus, you have the ability to kind of turn some of those things off. Without having to muck around with IAM permissions. So, I mean, like, there's pros and cons both ways, but I do sort of prefer the Amazon way because I feel like now I don't have to redeploy. I'm just enabling the expensive knob.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
As long as the expensive knob doesn't require redeployment.
Correct.
Because there's a few of those. Gotcha.
There's a few, but typically they also handle those for you
Yeah.
without too much downtime or with minimal to no impact as long as your app has good retry logic. Well, for those of the customers who do like spend a lot of money on expensive things, a SQL Server on GCP Cloud is now giving you the general availability of Cloud SQL Enterprise Plus Edition for SQL. That's a lot of SQL. SQL Enterprise Plus for SQL delivers new innovation that meets the needs of the most demanding SQL Server workloads without building on the core foundation of Cloud SQL. There's two new machine families for enhanced performance and higher memory per vCPU, a data cache for improved read performance, which is one I'm most excited about, and advanced DR capabilities and a 99.99% availability SLA for business continuity. The existing version of Cloud SQL for SQL Server will continue with no changes to features or pricing, but will now be known as Cloud SQL Enterprise Edition Plus, Enterprise Edition, and this new version will be Plus for a SQL Server. The enhanced node types are performance memory optimized up to 32 gigs of RAM per vCPU with as many as 128 vCPUs in the performance optimized machine family. And for read intensive workloads, Cloud SQL Enterprise Plus provides a configurable data cache that delivers high read performance, data cache leveraging server-side SSD as a way to persist the most frequently accessed data, lowering read latency and improving throughput.
Your CFO will hate you if you launch 128 vCPU SQL. That's all I have to say.
Maybe, you know, it depends on what you got to do with that thing. You're doing stuff for the CFO, you might be very happy because you got done real fast. But I mean, having a built-in read cache built into Cloud SQL for a SQL Server without having to do table pinning and all the other terrible things that you have to do to make SQL scale or manage a Redis cluster or memcached on the outside, like that's super nice. I have workload for that in my day job that I'm already talking to my DBA about. I'm like, hey, this would be perfect for this use case.
It is something that Azure has, which is called like application intent, which you can just pass that as part of the string, SQL string for it, and it will just automatically route you to the read-only replica if one's there, and if not, it routes you to the write, which is kind of a nice feature too that Azure has. It sounds like this is kind of the same thing, just
except for this is all on the same node. So yes, I mean you can do read-only replicas, and then yeah, you just pass the intent into the connection string. It'll pass you to the read-only side. But this is actually like a caching layer where they're actually in man-in-the-middling basically the SQL command and basically returning that data to you.
Okay.
Slightly different, but same idea. Yeah. I think Microsoft does have a solution similar to this that they make available in Azure SQL for those who want to spend a lot of money. Bigtable has grown up and became a true NoSQL solution with the inclusion of Google SQL, an ANSI-compliant SQL dialect used by Google products such as Spanner and BigQuery. Now you can use the same SQL with Bigtable to write apps for AI, fraud detection, data mesh, recommendations for any other application that benefit from real-time data. There's a quote here from Jun Kusana, Executive Officer, VP of Engineering at Plaid. Seamless SQL integration and efficient counter-functionality will empower us to build more robust and scalable solutions for our customers. We applaud Bigtable's commitment to innovation and eagerly anticipate leveraging these enhancements to simplify work with big, complex, and fast-moving data. And if a customer can tell you that you're innovating by adding a SQL layer to your database, that's just an easy win. take that every day of the week.
I guess the AIs were better at writing SQL statements than anything else, and so they implement SQL.
There's just so many examples of SQL statements out there that it's easy to get the AI to do it for you.
For those of you who have security teams that will allow you to run arbitrary Terraform code against your Google Cloud account, the Marketplace now provides an easy step-by-step guide to deploying a Marketplace VM using a Terraform script from the Google Cloud Marketplace UI in a few simple clicks. If you trust the Marketplace 100% and you want to just run arbitrary Terraform code in your account, just like you do CloudFormation on AWS, you can now make that simple for yourself.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
So I went in and tried to figure this one out. There's a button, and I just kept going in a loop in the blog post where it was like, press here to go do it, and it linked you back to the run thing that says, run your Terraform code by running Terraform in it and Terraform apply. I was very confused by this. So I didn't know if either one of you two kind of like played with this at all, or...
And so basically what they've done is they've, as a marketplace provider, you basically produce a module that you can then either run through a command line deployment by downloading the Terraform module to integrate it into your CI/CD pipeline. Or if you just click through the GUI, it launches it into Google Cloud Infrastructure Manager, which is basically their version of Terraform Enterprise for cloud. And that'll then do the deployment and apply process. So it really depends on how you want to do this, but it's very similar to click this button to get CloudFormation automatically deployed in your AWS account, which again, I don't recommend that either.
Yeah, it's nice that it tracks the deployments that you've made, so that if people have gone away and deployed a bunch of, what was the example in the blog post, BIP instances or whatever,
like F5 load balancers or something. Yeah,
I mean, just in case you really want to burn money. But I mean, you can track all the deployments from the marketplace, so you can see where they all are. You can see who's deployed what, and presumably if there's updated images, then the Terraform will be updated as well, and you could easily in-place upgrades. So it's kind of nice functionality, but the opportunity to actually inspect the Terraform and see what it's doing and see who it's running as and which permissions it has would be kind of nice. That's a little vague at the moment.
Yeah. There's a lot of gotchas to how to make Google Cloud Infrastructure Manager work and how what IAM permissions you need to have. So like, yeah, if you don't have the right things applied to your role, it won't work. So it's appreciated that it's an easy button, assuming you've done all the plumbing you needed to do in advance to make that work. If you prefer the security violation of running arbitrary Terraform code that you don't own.
But you know, of course, the irony there is that the security vendors are going to be the first people to use this make their tools easier to deploy.
Mm-hmm. Well, guys, I'm sorry to tell you, you might have already known this though, because I kind of knew. Google is a monopoly.
No.
Yeah. A judge ruled on Monday that Google violated antitrust law by paying other companies to make its search engine the default on smartphones. The ruling could force Google to change the way it runs its business and impact several other antitrust lawsuits involving Amazon, Apple, and Meta. The decision recognizes that Google offers the best search engine, but concludes that we shouldn't be allowed to make it easily available. We appreciate the court's finding that Google is the industry's highest quality search engine, which has earned Google the trust of hundreds of millions of daily users. This is a quote from Google, by the way. Has long been the best search engine, particularly in the mobile devices. Has continued to innovate in search, and Apple and Mozilla occasionally assess Google's search quality relative to its rivals and find Google to be superior. Given this, and that people are increasingly looking for information in more ways, we plan to appeal the decision. As this process continues, we will remain focused on making products that people find helpful and easy to use, says Kent Walker, president of global affairs at Alphabet.
I find this really interesting because partly I think they'll win an appeal. I hope they win an appeal.
Depends on the administration in office at the time.
But the weird thing is, like, it's common practice to pay for your product to be front and center. You just walk into a grocery store, and those things aren't placed randomly by employees. They're carefully mapped out. You know, Kellogg's pay for their things to be on certain shelves, certain height above the floor. You know, eye level for adults, eye level for kids. Like, there's a huge market in charging people for product placement, and I don't see having Google search being the default search on iPhones any different than any other kind of product placement.
I mean, are they going to essentially force Apple to say, okay, Google has Pixel and Android phones, so Apple, you can't use Google? It just feels like a weird thing to... Mm. Now you're starting to force other companies that are not Google to select what and how they use these tools, which feels weird too.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose when you first pair up a new phone, it could say, okay, now choose your search provider, and there'll be a list of vendors, and you have to specifically pick one, and you present it with them once. But then, you know, what order do they go in? They go in alphabetical order. But I think, I mean, Apple care about their customer experience, and Google search is and has been for a very long time the best tool around. Why wouldn't Apple want Google search to be the default search on their phones?
I guess the question, you know, because again, a couple of things about this. Apple's paid allegedly $20 million a year to make Google the preferred search engine. And Mozilla, apparently like 80% of their revenue comes from Google. You know, so that's a big deal for Mozilla Foundation. You know, and basically what the argument is basically that a new competitor in search would not have the dollars to be able to compete with that. And I'm looking at OpenAI, who's talking about building a search capability. And I'm like, well, they have a lot of money in raised capital dollars. I definitely think they could go to Apple and say, hey, I'm willing to pay you $25 million to be the default search. If it's good, then Apple will make the decision based on if it's good or not. And yes, I'll take your $25 million because, you know, I'm not silly.
Yeah. It's strange. Like that. Thinking about it as a new business in the space, having a hard time competing is probably the only argument that makes any sense in terms of the ruling, I think.
But again, like, I find it weird that this is the issue they have. The issue they have is around the fact that they're paying for placement in places, which I agree with you, like the supermarket is actually a really good defense. But like the ad market, which is the bigger area of monopoly in my mind, because they don't allow any other ad, you know, networks to be involved in Google search. Like, that's a bigger monopoly to me than the searches. Because again, like search, you'll go wherever you want to for search. If someone creates a better search engine, you'll go there. I mean, I used to use Yahoo, and then I used AltaVista, and I used Ask Jeeves, and, you know, all these different search engines at one point in time. And then Google came, and it was amazing, and it did the best job. And so I started just using that. And I tried to use DuckDuckGo because, you know, there was a point where it's like, oh, I shouldn't give Google all my data. And it's like, well, I sort of like the things that Google's giving me that are in its search algorithms versus what I'm getting out of DuckDuckGo, because going to DuckDuckGo was like going back to Yahoo, and I didn't feel like it was as good. Mm. And so you know, consumers make a choice, you know, and it's not that hard to switch on an iPhone to a different search provider. It's like 3 clicks or 4 clicks. Like, it's, I mean, I know where it's at. It's not easy for a new user. So maybe the finding is that, you know, Apple and their antitrust suit has to make a choice, you know, make it available as an easy choice as part of a setup of a new phone. That you get to pick your search engine. But again, like, these are silly things that I don't think are huge, huge monopoly problems.
Yeah. You think they'll win the appeal or no?
I feel like they could. I don't think they realize that the Firefox and the Apple would be such a big point of what the jury would point to as their monopoly power. Mm. And so I think they didn't know how to, they didn't focus their defense enough on it that I think in an appeal, they'll be able to argue their way out of that.
Yeah, interesting. It's like Android and Java and Oracle all over again.
Yep, all over again. Mm. I mean, I do wonder what happens with Amazon and Apple's antitrust case based on this, though.
Yeah, it's weird. I think, I mean, go back to the whole DuckDuckGo thing. I've used it as well for things, and it's like, it is 20-year-old technology. Mm-hmm. Google has got very good at giving you the answers to what you meant to ask and not what you did ask, whereas other search engines very much just you know, text indexes. I think Google applies some magic context to what you're actually looking for.
And you know, my best example of like that magic context is Google by now has to know I'm somewhere in the tech world, somewhere in the DevOps world, knows in the cloud world. Mm-hmm. So if I go type chef recipe or something, it's not going to give me recipes that a chef uses to cook in the kitchen. It's going to target me towards chef CM tools.
I'm going to try that right now. Chef recipe. Nope. Recipes for dinner. Right. Fun's the result.
That's always the worst thing about being a chef developer, was trying to find cookbooks for, yep, for things. They're like, why did you guys choose this of all the things?
That choice of name.
I will give them credit. I enjoy how far down that whole way they went.
Oh yeah, they dug into it.
They went to knife, mm-hmm, and recipes and cookbooks and everything
test
else,
kitchen and all this stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Like, I enjoy the fun of that they did.
Yes.
So,
but also, no one knew what chef was either. So it was sort of, you know, it's the risk of cute naming versus functional naming. All right, yeah. Azure is embracing the future of container native storage with the new Azure Container Storage capability. This is a platform-managed container native storage service in the public cloud. Azure Container Storage joins their suite of container services, tightly integrating with Kubernetes and simplifying your stateful workload management across Azure's set of comprehensive storage offerings. Azure Container Storage supports ephemeral disk, local NVMe or temp SSD, and Azure Disks. And with Azure Disk, you can take advantage of built-in resiliency by choosing between zone redundant storage options or multi-zone storage pools on local redundant storage, LRS, to deliver a highly available solution across zones. Server-side encryption is provided by default with platform-managed keys and enforced network security per respective backing storage options. You can further enhance the security by providing your own customer-managed key.
I'm confused.
A nice, solid add-on, I feel like, that you can now actually have the ephemeral disk.
Yeah.
Where, you know, no different than EBS back containers and all that stuff. So I'm a little surprised it wasn't there to start off, but you now have it. I'm still not saying that this is a good idea, but it's an idea.
I mean, stateful workloads are definitely a thing, though. Like, stateful workloads in the containers, we lost that argument years ago at this point.
I'm still fighting it. Still fighting it as much as I can. I might not be winning, but I'm fighting it.
Yeah, stateful containers and ephemeral disks in the same paragraph don't make a lot of sense to me, but I I get the cost if you don't need resiliency.
I read a little bit about this a few weeks ago, not this specific, but just like containers when it comes to even training your own models, like your own ML models, or you go into like LLMs and all that type of stuff, where some of it's just the container needs to boot up, get a sum of data to start its model on, hence the ephemeral disk. So it's sort of stateful because if the container crashes while it's, you know, running its section of the model, it can have problems. But it's, you know, it needs that, it wants that ephemeral to load any historical data or anything else that it needs to run its own future compilations. But I kind of get that like ephemeral local storage attached to it is for that aspect of it. I still just dislike containers that need a EPS.
Well, I mean, there's also storage. The use cases where you're training, you know, training AI or LLMs where you need, you know, you want to load stateful data to the container to then make it able to access that disk faster. So there are other use cases too that aren't just run your database on top of on top of Kubernetes.
Yeah, sure thing.
You go build that for us, Jess.
Sure, I'll get right on that. Well, you know, earlier I showed my disdain for all the AI announcements we're continuing to do every week by creating three podcast hosts on Titan who were annoyed about talking about AI and not talking about cool things like network firewalls. And OCI delivered for me this week and gave me announcing tunnel inspection for OCI network firewalls. This feature allows for a new use case using threat analysis capabilities with their native virtual test access port service or VTAP. This combination allows for comprehensive traffic analysis through a dedicated out-of-band channel, enables detection of malicious sources or destinations, identification of inappropriate crypto traffic, and spotting of SSH sessions targeting known command and control domains. Packet mirroring, be still my data center heart.
I miss just fun cloud announcements like this. Like, it's a good, solid feature that they are adding to the cloud to make a compliance / security person happy. Like, this is sometimes what I just miss of just straight core cloud features that we don't get all the time anymore.
Yeah. I mean, this is what we created the cloud pod for, was to talk about stuff like this and why you did use it. And, you know, like, I don't know that I want to have an out of band traffic flow of my encrypted tunnel traffic, but, you know, hey, if you need this for security compliance, this is cool. It's great to have it and you have the ability to do it now. But it has been a little bit for the last year now, just a lot of AI. So I do hope that, you know, I saw Andy Jassy talked about, you know, needing to have, make sure you have a successful outcome of all this AI investment. I saw some other people talking about some of the, you know, in the earnings world about all these AI investments need to make money and there's unclear paths to money for some of these things. So I'm hoping maybe our knee jerk into everyone has to have all AI all the time is maybe coming to some level of back to the middle versus so far pegged to one side or the other. Because I don't mind AI stuff. Like the old days of having a couple ML announcements a month mixed in with our other cloud infrastructure stuff was always fine. But yeah, it's just so much AI right now.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with AI right now is like, okay, we've been over the image generation thing, and okay, we've done the large language models, and yes, we can write some fake stuff, and I think the exciting bit is going to be where people come up with some really cool use cases for it.
But I do think we're limited by the type of AI that we've designed. You know, this predictive text based AI capability, you know, it only has so many use cases before you run out of, you know, it doesn't do what you really need to do or what truly people believe AI is, which is, you know, the sci-fi version of AI. You know, like there is a limited utility. And I've kind of saying that for a long time. I think even on this show is that, you know, I do think there is an overhype problem. The bubble is too big for what AI can do. You know, companies saying they're going to fire all their designers because AI can design things. You know, yeah, you can design people with 12 fingers. So cool. You know, like there's still a need for people who are good at what they do. And so I think people have sort of chased something that isn't real yet, but you know, it could be real soon. I think it's not as good as people think it is.
I think there's going to be good use cases for it. I don't think the bar shop needs a, you know, the local repair shop needs a AI bot on their website to do whatever they can think of. But I think there are features in specific products. And, you know, maybe I'm biased, but I feel like some of the stuff that my day job is kind of working on is pretty cool, and where it's going to end up, you know, is a good feature that actually will help people versus like, we threw a bot in here. We can type words and make generational pictures. Like, I think like if you actually embed it into your technology, into your platform, and make it be a part of it versus like, we've augmented this thing onto the side that kind of works, but not really. So it, like you said, I feel like it's really about the implementation now of what people do with it.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of some really good examples though of where it would be useful. I mean, you go to the like Napa Auto Parts or something, and like, my car's making a funny noise. It's doing this, or it's got this thing is happening. Like, you could offload that entirely to AI, and somebody could chat on the website, and it wouldn't cost you the cost of paying that employee to sit and chat with somebody for half an hour about this rattle noise they've got or whatever. So I mean, you could still like use it as a sales funnel and help people diagnose things, and then you know, not take up a person's time.
All I can think of is when you said Napa Auto Parts was the Phoenix Project, and like
unlimited auto parts.
I might have stopped listening to after that because I was like, oh, well, there they're talking about how to make employees more efficient and everything else by actually having technology work for them. That's all my brain went to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think
how many of those books have you read now, Matt? Like, I know you were doing Phoenix Project, and then I think you said you're going to do the developer one. And then did you get to Compliance Unlimited too?
We have not done it. We're doing a couple chapters every other week. Kind of, you know, actually read them, talk about them as a group and whatnot, and slowly, you know, build up from there. So we are slowly going through them. I did not follow my own instructions to my team, where I actually just said, nope, I'm too impatient, and just listened to all the books. So yeah, I'm a bad person.
Remind me not to join your book club.
Yeah. I'm not patient. Well, I listen to the audiobook, so I'm like, okay, cool. I go take the dog for an hour long walk, and I'll just listen to an hour of the book. So yeah.
I mean, people do kind of make fun of LLMs today and just kind of reduce them to next word predictors. And I think that's, while technically true, I think it's kind of mischaracterizing or underestimating what they can really do for people. Because people...
It's a gross oversimplification, for sure.
Yeah, it is. But people communicate using words or text every day. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very close to being incredibly useful.
And there are very common speech patterns and ways that people talk and those things. It just, you know, it doesn't do the highly creative stuff that people think it's going to do. And that's the part that I think they don't quite get. Like, yes, it can make writing an email to a customer much easier. It can give you boilerplates. It can give you scaffolding for coding. It can do all these things. But like the actual part where you had to get creative and do something that is unique and new, it can't do that. And that's, it can't invent yet. So maybe someday it will. I just don't know that this model, I don't know if the text prediction models will do that at the level we want. But we'll see. We'll find out.
Yep.
I'm not willing to bet against it at this moment.
No.
All right, guys. Well, we'll see you next week here at the Cloud Pod.
Yep. See you later.
See ya.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod.